This is an ABC podcast.
You've worked for years through high school, uni, and placements to get into a job that you're really passionate about. Maybe you're a nurse, a doctor, an ambo, a pharmacist. You're a frontline worker who got into this because you wanted to do some good. But just as you're kicking off the career that you've been so excited about, COVID hits. Your dream quickly turns into a nightmare, and now you're the one who needs support. G'day, Dave Marchese with you for Hack. It's our first show for 2022 and our first look back on a summer that a lot of you would rather forget. You've had leave cancelled, holidays ruined, and at this point so many of you are telling us that you're burnt out, angry, and you just want to find a new job. So what's next? Also coming up, WA's COVID situation is getting very real. For ages, the big state's been called a hermit kingdom. But is that all about to end?
Hack.
I've only been in the job for less than 3 years and I've never felt so unsupported by our government.
On Triple J.
Yeah, so that hot fact summer that we're all hoping for didn't really turn out the way we expected, did it? And there have been hundreds of thousands of COVID cases thanks to the Omicron variant. And while some leaders have been insisting that the health system is coping, when we asked young healthcare workers how they're coping, the overwhelming response was, we're not. The last 2 years of the pandemic have put so much pressure on the healthcare system that some young workers are already reconsidering their careers. Jo Lauder has spoken to some about how they're feeling at the moment.
So I just feel like all the exhaustion just comes out in tears. Like you can't explain yourself and you just go, like people just ask you a simple question, like today, you know, how are you going? And I'm like, I can't talk and I just have tears rolling down my face today, all of today.
Elise is a nurse at a country hospital in New South Wales. She's one of the healthcare workers who wrote into us last week about what it's like at the moment. Elise told me she's not usually a crier, but she's cried more in the past couple of months than her entire life. She works in an emergency department, but because it's a smaller hospital, when she's not at work, she's still on call a lot of the time.
And yeah, you just feel guilty. It's just a guilt trip. And I know, like, we're told, but, you know, you go into nursing because you care for others. I'm like, yeah, I do. But at the expense, currently, it's at the expense of our mental and physical health. And it's at the expense of our friends, our family, because we're not seeing them.
Elise says this latest wave of COVID cases has left other parts of their hospital understaffed.
As soon as something happens, we lose staff members to our COVID rooms, our COVID ward. We don't have the staff to pull, so the other areas, the non-COVID stuff gets short-staffed, essentially.
It is so, so hot and exhausting.
Sally's 22 and she's a registered nurse, and she spent her first year out of uni working at a drive-through COVID testing site in South Australia. She says the full PPE they have to wear every day makes it even hotter than it already is.
It makes the work you're doing so much harder and more exhausting on your body. It adds, I would say, at least 5 degrees because we're working outside already and you can't have any water while you're in the drive-thru.
When it's hot, they rotate teams every half hour to make sure people don't get heat exhaustion. But Sally reckons they need more staff to cope.
Absolutely, staffing. 100% staffing, 1,000,000% staffing. Oh my gosh.
And she says, please don't take it out on them.
Another thing that I really want people to know is that we're trying our hardest. We can't help if we are understaffed. We try so hard.
As we all know, there's been an unprecedented wave of COVID cases this summer. And even if Omicron causes fewer hospitalisations, it's put so much pressure on the health system. Last week, the Victorian government activated a Code Brown, which means hospitals can redeploy staff to where they're most needed, cancel people's leave to boost numbers, and focus on essential services only. We put a call out up on our Instagram asking how frontline workers are doing at the moment. And we got hundreds of responses, with young workers saying basically, no, we're not coping.
It is absolutely really, really hard at the moment. And this is on the back of 2 years of pretty exhaustive process at work. So it's not surprising at all.
Dr. Sarah Whitelaw is the emergency medicine spokesperson for the Australian Medical Association, and she works in emergency in Melbourne. According to Dr. Whitelaw and all the other healthcare workers we've spoken to, the problems they're dealing with aren't just to do with Omicron causing an influx of patients at hospitals. That's obviously happening, but there just aren't enough staff to keep up.
our normal, our pre-pandemic was not okay. We ran at or over 100% capacity before this pandemic hit. So we have nowhere to go except over the cliff.
Dr. Whitelaw says she thinks leaders are saying that the health system is coping, even when staff are so burnt out, is so people still go into hospital when they need it.
That discordant message that everything is fine and that the health system is prepared and it's coping well is really contributing to a lot of stress, and that's something that we wish would change immediately.
Tim is a registered nurse at a metro hospital in Victoria, and he's in his first year on the job.
We're not coming in to bring the best healthcare results possible to our patients anymore. We're just coming in to keep them alive, and we're just coming in to keep our co-workers sane.
He says everyone is burnt out.
We're all beginning to show signs of PTSD, and we know these signs and symptoms. We're waking up in cold sweats from memories and dreams of patients spitting at us and biting us and throwing punches at us. It's been really, really bad.
Tim says he's seen lots of really experienced healthcare workers leave. Some of them retire early or change professions or get better paid work elsewhere.
Vaccination hubs are taking staff away, skilled, experienced staff away because they pay more. Swabbing facilities are taking staff away, experienced, passionate staff because they pay more than what we get paid at the bedside. And I can't blame anybody for leaving.
Hack Triple J.
Joe Lauder with that story, and we're hearing lots from you right now. Somebody says, working at a major hospital right now, it's stressful and exhausting. Shortages all round, PPE, rats, staff, communication, it's a dog's breakfast. Another person, I'm a disabled emergency department nurse and I feel like we've had no support in Melbourne. I'm 28 and I feel like I'm 80 years old. All the government's shown me is that sports and tradies are supported, but the health sector is not. We're going to keep this chat going and switch from nurses to another group slammed over the past few months, paramedics. Patrick is an AMBO in Sydney and he joins me now. Patrick, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thank you for having me.
Now, if you had to sum up this summer at work for you in a word, what do you reckon you'd choose?
I'm going to say shit. And I think you'd get that same word from most people you asked about how the summer was. There's no other way to describe it. It's like a shitstorm.
Patrick, are you able to paint us a bit of a picture of what it's like to be a paramedic in Sydney, one of the hardest hit areas of the country in terms of COVID, right now?
It's stressful from the minute you turn up to work. I'll have to say even on the way to work, you're stressing, you're thinking, what are we in for today? We know that the ambulance service is basically stretched beyond capacity. We know that patients are waiting up to 10 hours for an emergency response. So my biggest stress before I even start the day is, what am I in for? You know, what sort of a reaction am I going to get from my patients when I turn up 10 hours late, when they're expecting an immediate response? We're doing things now which we never would have imagined doing, you know, 2 years ago, leaving patients at home who are feeling quite crook and telling them you're not sick enough to go to hospital. Things like I've had to bail 5 young kids into the back of the ambulance to drive them to a relative's house because the whole family was COVID positive. Both parents were so sick they needed to go to hospital, but because they were positive, there was no one allowed to come into the house to look after the kids. So we had to find a relative who was also COVID positive, bundle the kids into the back of the ambulance and drive them to a relative's house. It's just very different from the job I joined.
We've heard a lot of healthcare workers say that they're suffering compassion fatigue. Can you explain a bit what paramedics and other healthcare workers mean by that?
Yeah, look, it's a real thing. And I think we've probably all experienced it at some point in our lives. We've just given it a fancy name. It's basically, you know, I think we all know the bucket analogy. Compassion's the same. You have an empty bucket of compassion at the start of the day. And as you give that compassion to people throughout the day, it fills up. It fills up, and it fills up to the point where you can't fit any more compassion in that bucket. And the compassion you give out is, you use empathy to empathize with your patient. Sometimes some are more deserving than others, but we have to be professional, empathetic no matter what. But it takes a little piece of you away every time you give some compassion, empathy to somebody. And that's somebody that you don't even know. And what it feels like is you've got nothing left to give. So at the end of the day, you come home to your family after a day of giving out all your reassurance and compassion and love, and you've got none left to give to your family. So they get the grumpy version of you. It's hard to deal with because you start saying to yourself, I'm giving my soul to people I don't even know, and I'm not giving anything to the family I love.
As someone on the front line, what were your thoughts when you heard, for example, the New South Wales Premier Dominic Perrottet claim earlier this month that hospitals were in a strong position, that things were going okay?
I think the word he used was coping, and that word has really triggered some anger amongst healthcare workers. And when I say healthcare workers, I'm talking on behalf of paramedics, but I'm hearing it from everyone within the system, the hospital staff, from nurses, doctors, clerical staff, cleaners, orderlies. There's a whole bunch of people that are the system. And when the Premier says that the system is coping, he's talking about the people within that system. And the people within that system are not coping. They are propping up the system, yes. We're keeping it afloat by sacrificing ourselves in terms of both our physical health, our mental health, our emotional well-being. And it's easy to dehumanize us by calling us the system. But when he breaks it down, and if he broke it down, he would see that the system is not coping. It's coping despite the fact that we're all struggling.
Do you think that this threat of a mass exodus is real, that we could see across the country people leaving in big droves?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. It's already happening. I don't know one single colleague who's not talking about what their exit strategy is. What it means is we're going to be losing a lot of our more experienced on-road paramedics just due to the pressure that they've experienced over the last 2 years. So while I don't think it's going to affect numbers in terms of mass exodus, what it is going to change is the breadth and quality and scope of experience that we have.
So you've probably heard maybe some people out there who say, oh, Omicron, it's a lot less severe, we're all going to catch it. And, you know, they're going out there maybe wanting to catch the virus to get it out of the way so they feel like they've got some immunity. As someone who's a healthcare worker, someone on the front line seeing the other side of all the numbers, the very real side, what would you say to people who are doing that?
I hate to say it, but often it's people in their 20s who are relatively mild who are calling an ambulance for reassurance. And they're the ones who I think are the same people who a week earlier would have said, oh, I don't care if I catch it, because I'm seeing some of them that aren't vaccinated that are getting the virus, calling an ambulance saying, I'm feeling really sick. And I'll say, yes, that's what the virus does, but you're not sick enough to go to hospital, unfortunately. You just have to wait this out at home. So they're tying up the system. So don't have COVID parties, guys. Yeah. No Omicron orgies, nothing.
It's pretty fair advice, I think. Yeah. Patrick, it's been a huge few months. You guys have been going through it. So many people getting in touch wanting to thank you and all the other paramedics for your work. And thanks so much for making the time to jump on Hack and talk to us.
Yeah, look, no worries at all. Thanks for having us.
Hack on Triple J.
Yeah, and on the text line as well, a lot of comments coming through. Somebody says, I don't hate my job, but I'm a bit burnt out. Also stuck in isolation this week as a close contact. Another person says, I work as a cleaner in a regional hospital doing only cleaning of areas of COVID contacts. It's frantic. We do lifts, x-rays, CT, anywhere that a COVID positive patient's been. It doesn't just affect frontline staff either. I'm a junior doctor in Sydney, another person. The pandemic has exposed deep vulnerabilities in the healthcare system, huge shortages of staff all over, looking for an exit from the system ASAP. On the line, Taryn is with us. Taryn, you've been working in a COVID ward for the past year and a half. How's it been?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's certainly not something that, you know, when we graduated, I didn't foresee any of this happening. You know, the excitement of graduation was enough that I probably had rose-coloured glasses on the first couple of months and found myself in the middle of a pandemic, as did all of my colleagues. But the hours have been long, and to be honest with you, in the last few months, the patients are just sicker, you know. There's a real selection bias in the hospital where we used to have probably 30 to 40% of the population who were stable. Now we simply can't admit those patients, you know. So we've only got really unwell people, which in and of itself can be both draining and exhausting.
And do you reckon there's a bit of a disconnect, Taryn, between people who are healthcare workers and those who aren't? Like, do you have friends or family who aren't in the system and then think, oh, everything's fine, it all seems to be okay, we'll live life normally?
I don't know if it, perhaps I'm a little different in that my family and friends, I think, are quite involved in my day-to-day work and, you know, really do appreciate. But I hear these comments, you know, Dominic comes out and says things like the healthcare system's coping, and then I go to work on a 14-hour shift for the seventh day in a row and think, well, are we? You know, I think perhaps there's more of a disconnect with the federal and state politicians rather than the community at large. I think the community is very understanding, and other than a very select few, I haven't really come across anyone who dismisses how hard everyone's working, you know, from the cleaning staff to the cooks to the doctors and nurses. But I think it's more of a kind of ingrained in politics rather than the community at large.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear that you're not hearing it in the community, Taryn. Thank you so much, and thanks for your work. Someone who can tell us a bit more about this situation we're now in is Dr. Erin Smith. She's part of the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine. Erin, thanks for jumping on Hack.
Happy to be with you, Dave.
We've just been hearing about this enormous stress that frontline workers have been under during the pandemic, and particularly with this Omicron strain. Do you think that there's more that our governments could have done to prepare for this?
Yeah, I think that, and the signs were there really early on as well. I know that I was involved in some research right in the very first wave of the pandemic in Australia, where we interviewed some 600 paramedics, nurses and doctors about the concerns that they had working within the pandemic. And so this was in March, April of 2020, right when this was just starting to take off. And even back then, we found that about a third of the people that we spoke to were already reporting symptoms of burnout. And about 42% of the people that we spoke to were less willing, or reporting that they were less willing to work in those roles than they were before the pandemic. So the signs were there really early on, like almost 2 years ago, and yet we still haven't really done much to support those at the front line in terms of their well-being, their mental health, and just generally in terms of all those issues that all these incredible people you've been talking to already today have been expressing. So yes, absolutely, I think our government have let us down at the state level and at the federal level, and at every level we can think of, we've been let down.
Yeah, we're hearing from a lot of people. Someone else, I'm a nurse in Sydney, we're so short-staffed that I was asked to come into work the day after I tested positive for COVID, as long as I wore full PPE my entire shift. This is a huge stress that healthcare workers in particular have been under. When we're talking about planning for huge things like this pandemic, surely there are officials who should be preparing for this sort of stuff. Is that what's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, lots of planning is going on, and I know I personally was part of planning for the Code Brown plan in Victoria that was mentioned by one of your guests just earlier as well. So lots of planning has been done, but I think we've just really underestimated how long this particular public health emergency was going to go on for, and just how severe and profound the impact was going to be on the healthcare system, not only across Australia, but globally. And look, it is a real impact. And we know international data is now suggesting that one in five healthcare workers has actually left their job.
Wow.
Since the pandemic started. And so when I started digging into some data from Australia, we found that 20,000 nurses have left their profession in the past year alone here in Australia. Now, that's not insignificant when you think we've only got about 400,000 registered nurses in total. So 20,000 have walked away this year alone just because of COVID. So we need to be doing something about this.
So what's going to be the impact of that? If we have all these people leaving, obviously it's going to mean it's going to be harder to fill shifts maybe, but what are some of the other impacts that we could see on our health workforce?
Yeah, well, you were just speaking to Patrick, the paramedic there, and he touched on a really important point, because we're losing really valuable experience from the workforce, and that's the stuff that is so hard to replace. We can replenish the staff. That even alone is going to take time. But it's that valued lived experience that we're losing, that we're never going to really replace, or takes a long time to replace. So it's that mentorship, it's the leadership, it's the sharing of the lived experience. And a lot of these people that we're losing are ones that have been in the workforce for a really long time. It's been their whole life's work, their career. And I know I've spoken to a number of nurses today alone, and one of them said, you know, she's been working in this area since 1982. And when I said to her, how are you going? And she said, I'm beyond broken, and that she leaves her soul at the door each time she walks into the hospital. And it just made me, I was heartbroken to think that these are the kinds of people that are now going to retire early. You know, they're going to retire early and leave the system, and we're losing that kind of those kind of people out of our healthcare system. Is just devastating.
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing so many messages very similar to this, people talking about just the emotional impact of it and the compassion fatigue that they just don't have any more to give. Did experts know that this would happen, that we would end up in a pandemic situation?
I mean, there are a lot of us researchers and academics and people working in all sorts of policy and stuff that predicted it. We've modelled it. We've done all sorts of planning in the background and looked at worst case scenarios. And this was always one of the things that we said to leaders and to government and to policymakers, that you are going to have a fatigued healthcare system and a fatigued healthcare workforce. But I just don't think they ever really realised just how crippling it was going to be. And COVID has proved to be crippling not only to the healthcare system, but to, you know, the people. We probably looked at how we were going to manage resources in terms of, you know, the physical things like beds and ventilators, but perhaps overlooked the most vital resource that we have, and that's our people.
And I guess, you know, different parts of the country are dealing with things differently. In some parts of the country now, they're saying, oh, maybe we're seeing the peak. In other parts like WA, which we're about to talk about, they're only just starting to see the beginning of outbreaks. So is it about sharing and finding better access across the country to resources?
Yeah, and I think that's certainly a really important conversation that we need to be having, and it's something that we've certainly been looking at here in Victoria, as our whole state has gone to Code Brown, which has been that activation of those emergency plans. And I know when I was certainly part many, many years ago of a working group that looked at those Code Brown plans, and we never ever dreamt or discussed of such a large-scale activation across the whole state. Those kind of emergency Code Brown plans were only ever sort of thought to be activated after an emergency or a disaster that would affect a single or a couple of hospitals. But we never thought the whole state would have to be activated at once. But the good thing about that is that all of those hospitals are now talking and planning and working together and sharing resources and allocating resources as an entire system rather than individual hospitals. And I think that's maybe the way we need to be approaching this as a whole country now, and trying to look at how we share resources, including people, across the whole country. Because here on the eastern, where I am in Melbourne, on, you know, the east coast of Australia, we are so fatigued. And I know just the figures that I've been getting reported today is that here in Victoria, we've got over 4,000 staff furloughed. New South Wales, over 5,500 staff furloughed. Hospitals routinely working at 25 to 40% understaffed every single shift. Yeah. And as Patrick was saying, you know, they're finding similar kinds of cases, you know, with, you know, the ambulance services as well. It's just not sustainable.
Yeah, it's not. And we're certainly learning a lot of lessons. Dr. Erin Smith from the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine, thanks so much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Hack.
And a lot of people say, oh, we should be living with COVID.
There is no government on the planet that has had more time to prepare than the McGowan government.
Now, what's going on in the eastern states is both an emergency and a catastrophe.
On Triple J.
Barnaby Joyce called it a hermit kingdom. He even compared it to North Korea. Yeah, Western Australia's copped a fair bit of criticism during the pandemic for its decision to pretty much cut itself off from most of the country to stop COVID cases. But it's all looking shaky now. WA's reporting a spike in COVID cases over the weekend. And just this afternoon, Western Australia recorded 13 new local cases of COVID. WA's health minister's now admitted that Omicron is too transmissible and it can't be eliminated from WA. So what's next for the big state? What does this mean for travel and family reunions? Jenna Clark's a journo. She's an associate editor with The Australian based in Perth, and she's with me now. G'day, Jenna.
Hello from the People's Republic of WA.
What do you think when you hear that? A hermit kingdom in North Korea. It's pretty wild.
Well, look, it's pretty wild. And sometimes I think a lot of corners of the community would probably agree with Mr. Joyce today. But what I found particularly galling is when he calls the Prince of Perth, compared Mark McGowan to the Prince of Perth, and anyone that's worth their salt in WA knows that that title is for Benny Cousins back in the early 2000s.
So seriously, though, what's the feeling in the West now that we have this outbreak? It's growing. The numbers, yeah. The numbers are slightly down, I think, today. But what's the sentiment in the community, Jenna?
Yeah, look, it's been really interesting. We had Amber Jade Sanderson, who is the she's pretty fresh in the role of health minister over here after Roger Cook sort of stepped away from the position after serving about 13 years, both in opposition and in government as health minister. Amber Jade has now stepped in as a fresh set of eyes and a fresh pair of some fresh energy into the health sector, which is it's a little under the pump, even without COVID. And yesterday she gave a press conference where she basically described all of the East Coast being in lockdown in all but name. And I think a lot of people over east probably correctly scratch their heads when they're like, well, I can still travel to Queensland.
Oh, and we've lost Jenna there. We're going to go to someone on the line, though. Brooke, you're in WA and you're happy with Mark McGowan and his decisions. What do you think about that?
I think he's done the best that he can do. Keeping the border shut obviously kept us a lot safer than what we're seeing in the other states. We've been able to sit back and unfortunately view what's going on in the other states and seeing the havoc that it's caused. And we've been lucky enough to not have half the restrictions that other states have had, but we can see that it is going to go that way.
Yeah, a lot of people are kind of, you know, really interested in seeing what the other states have done, but are really backing Mark McGowan's, you know, decisions that he's made. We're going to go back to Jenna Clark. Jenna, in terms of Mark McGowan's strategies, have they been pretty popular with the electorate?
Look, he was Mr. 89% before the state election in early 2021, and I think it's sort of it's held that he is incredibly popular leader, and I think a lot of West Australians that don't have links outside of the state are fully backing the fact that he's remained a hard line, wanting to crush the virus in WA. But I think the reality is it's now we're ticking over more than 2 years where we've been shut off from the rest of the world, and I think the opposition and certain members of the community, specifically business leaders, and those that are desperate to see loved ones outside of the, on the other side of the rabbit proof fence, are right to ask questions. What have you actually been doing for the past 2 years? You've been sitting on a budget surplus of around $5 billion thanks to booming iron ore prices, which is the major resource in this town. So I think a lot of people are asking a lot of questions, and rightly so. And I think the Premier needs to come up with a plan as soon as possible. I'm not saying that he needs to open up the borders, like he said, on February 5, but to say that we're not moving ahead with the plan in a late night press conference and then offer no alternative, I think has disappointed and left a lot of people very, very angry.
Some people angry, some people happy. We've got a message here. I appreciate what the Premier Mark is trying to achieve. The question does need to be asked, what has he spent the last two COVID-free years doing? As you said, Jenna, that's the sentiment of some people. Mel from Perth, she says, I and many of my family members are so relieved to hear about the border remaining shut. Can I ask about vaccination? With other parts of the country, when we saw outbreaks happening, we saw a big upswing in vaccination rates. Is that what we're going to be seeing in WA, or what you're already seeing now?
Well, it's really interesting because at the end of last year, when in November, the Premier said, look, there will be a plan to a plan and I'll let you know that plan soon. In December, we got an announcement that the plan is this, and the safe transition mechanism was, I'm not going to open the borders until 90% of West Australians are fully vaccinated. And we've pretty much reached that. So that is an incredible feat considering no one else in the country or the world had a head start like we had. Now the goalposts have moved, and those wanting to either leave the state or re-enter the state, if they have a recent connection to this place, have to be triple vaxxed. So you have to have your booster, and then you also then have to isolate for 14 days in quarantine. So vaccination rates have been tracking very well, considering we haven't had a major outbreak here. So COVID is pretty foreign to us, but we're an incredibly compliant place. You know, at this point in time, we have buying restrictions on a number of goods in our supermarkets. Some of our shelves are pretty bare. And when we do go out into, you know, pubs and our workplaces and our offices, we have to mask up. So because of these cases that continue to climb, even with the border, I think a lot of people are now going, we have COVID here and it's growing. What's the point of the border?
All right, Jenna Clark from The Australian, thank you so much for your time. That's all we've got time for on Hack this afternoon.
Hack on Triple J.
And that's all for the Hack podcast for now. My first ever. It's been such a pleasure hanging out. I'll catch you tomorrow.
This is an ABC podcast.